So this is a very special occasion tonight, very special meeting of all the people here. We've all left behind something to be here. We've all given up something. We've all made choices. In parts of our lives, each day we reach forks and decisions, we have to go one way or the other. And somehow the winding and confused and seemingly random and improbable events of our lives have led up to us being here together in this space. And so all of the possibilities, all of the potentials have been left behind, and we just have this one thing which is in front of us right now. And this is what we call the present moment. So just think about all the things that's happened in our lives, all the things in our memories, all of the wonderful meals that we've had, all of the great friends that we've made, our family, all the events, the things that we're so excited about, achievements, academic achievements or achievements at work or creative things. If you've ever written a song or made a painting or something, all of those things that you've done, none of them exist anymore. They're all in the past. And only what is here is what is real. So it's in the present moment and in coming to pay attention to the present moment that we come face to face with reality, as it were, for the first time. Of course, you know, the present moment is always there. We're never away from it. But we're not aware of it. We're not reflecting about it. So this is this very human capacity that we have, is to the capacity to reflect, to turn our awareness around, and to know, to reflect on this experience, what's actually happening here in the present moment. And when we do that, things that become apparent is that in that experience, in what's actually what's present to us, there's no all of the conventions and dichotomies of the world all fall away. There's no man and woman. There's no black or white. There's no Buddhist or Christian or Muslim. There's no left wing or right wing, young and old. All of those ways that we like to construct the world and construct a sense of meaning and our place in the world, normally we orient our place in the world by the ideas that we have. We belong to such and such a political party, or we such and such a club, or we have such and such hobbies, such and such preferences. We like this kind of food or that kind of music. We wear this kind of clothes. We have a badge that shows our belonging to this kind of club. And all of these things are signs that help to construct our own peculiar sense of individual identity. And none of those are present here. So I'm not Sujato. I look at my present moment here. There's no Sujato there. There's no monk. There's no abbot. There's no internationally notorious troublemaker in Buddhism or any of the other things which... which I use to define my sense of identity with. All of those are externals. You know, I met my dad in the airport today, and we arranged because he was flying through to Thailand for a holiday, and he stopped over in the airport, and I was going to meet him, and when we were arranging where to meet him, he said, "Wear something distinctive." think that's a bit of trouble. And this kind of this external identity we like to try to shape our sense of who we are by what we wear or how we present or whatever. And when we look inside and we actually see the present moment, none of those things are there. They just don't exist. Where are they? There's nothing. And say, well, what actually is there? What does that experience consist of? Well, it consists of experiences, sense experience. And we can hear things. We're sitting here listening to this talk. You can hear. Yeah. We can see if we open our eyes and look, you can see. We can smell, we can taste, we can touch. And there's always some kind of touch experience in things. And of course there's the mind, there's our thoughts and so on from what's happening. That's what's real, that's what our world consists of. And our very notion of reality, our notion of a world, of a life, is just what we've made out of these six senses. That's all. There's nothing else to it. There's nothing behind it. And so often in philosophy or metaphysics or religion or something like that, you're trying to look for what lies behind this world of appearances. So you're trying to say, is there a God, or is there a soul, or is there some kind of essence of being or ground of being or something. And you're trying to look for what's lying behind this actual experience, whereas the Buddhist approach is very much to look at the world as experienced and as constructed, to understand how we put that together, to understand that process by which we are from moment to moment building and constructing the world that we live in, taking the data and the information that we're being fed through our senses, processing that through means of our own experience, what we're familiar with, our ideas, our thoughts, our desires, our aversions, and constructing a world in order to suit us, in a world which places us at the center. And so we notice that whenever we construct the world, if we again just see how experience works, when we sit here and you sit in meditation, there's always there's an I at the center of this whole experience. So I feel like I'm sitting here at the middle and the world is kind of spread out around me. That's how experience works. So we're always at the center of our world. And that's how the activity of consciousness works, is by constructing a world that somehow places the I at the center of it. So when we come to look at this thing we call Buddhism or Buddhist practice, you realize that in that experience, of course, there's no Buddhism, right? And so of course Buddhism exists as a conventional reality like any other conventional reality. That you can look at the census figures and see how many people in Australia call themselves Buddhist. You can look at the different practices that people call Buddhist. The bowing and chanting and the Buddha images and so on. And the things that the Buddhist traditions that we have, and Sangha traditions and so on. And none of those actually exist in that experience, in that reality, in that truth. And if we look at those things which the Buddha himself claimed to be the centerpiece of his teachings, we also find that these conventionally constructed dichotomies and so on are simply not part of those. So those things that the Buddha taught again and again and again, the Four Noble Truths, is suffering. It's just an experience. It's what we experience. We're sitting here right now. You can feel pain. That's suffering. Origin of suffering. has to be investigated. Yeah, the ending of suffering, the finding of peace, and the way to the ending of suffering is the Noble Eightfold Path. These are all things that we can investigate in our own experience. We can see how we suffer. We can see our own grief, our own anger, the pain in our hearts, whether the trivial things, all the way up to the very kind of profound sense of anxiety and depression and so on. We can see that. That's not an abstract doctrine. It's not something you have to take on faith. It's a reality which is present before us in this present moment, here, right now, and in every moment of our lives. It's an ever-present. It's almost like an overpoweringly obvious truth. It's a truth which is so present that we have to try to convince ourselves that it's not. Very much of the work of our mind and the way that our mind constructs itself is to create kind of layers of denial and avoidance tactics around that, to avoid facing up to the suffering in our own hearts. So we find all of these ways to distract and amuse ourselves so that we can avoid facing this question, it's very understandable. There's nothing kind of wrong with that, but just to acknowledge that that's what in fact that we're doing. And suffering is not an easy thing to confront. So suffering, the origin of suffering, where does it come from? Well, from our own greed, hatred and delusion. We're the origin of our suffering. Our own unwholesome impulses. And when we recognize that, then that gives us some hope, because again, that's an empirical reality. It's not something that you have to believe on faith. It's not something esoteric or abstract or abstruse. It's something which is very real and very present and very immediate for everyone all the time. But we try to pretend that it's not the case. That actually it's our own greed, our own attachments, our own desires, and our own aversions and anger which is causing ourselves suffering. And of course it's our delusion which covers it all up. Yeah? It's the ignorance which is hiding the fact that we know where that suffering is coming from. And the good part about that is that none of those things are beyond us. None of those things are... They're all very normal things. Everybody has them. And we also know what it's like to not have them. So just as everyone knows what it's like to have greed and jealousy and anger and aversion and all of those things, we also know what it's like to not have them. And I'm sure there's many of you sitting here right now who don't have them. Yeah, actually in your mind, many people are just sitting here quite happy and enjoying listening to Dhamma, not feeling angry or averse, and just look into our mind now, because often we only notice these things when they're there. We say, oh, I got angry the other day, I yelled at someone. We don't say, well, I didn't get angry, I walked down the street this morning and I didn't get angry at everything. Yeah? The sun shone, I'm perfectly fine with that. Yeah. So we don't notice when these things are absent. And so this is one of the great contemplations which the Buddha asked us to do, is contemplate when it's there, it's there. When it's absent, you contemplate when it's absent. And that's one of the important things. So sometimes when we practice through Buddhist practice and Buddhist meditation, and what we call mindfulness practice, we always practice to be mindful of what's there. But the Buddha actually, in the Satipatthana Sutta, he said, be mindful of what's absent. Yeah? You don't just be aware when there's a painful feeling in your body, yeah, in meditation. You be aware when there's no painful feeling. It's a very, very important practice. And I talked a little bit about this on the recent retreat that we did, but often in meditation circles you'll hear quite a lot of almost like a kind of a worship of pain. Pain is your teacher, pain is your guide, and so on, all of which I disagree with strongly. And I propose this as a principle in practice. In the Buddha, when he said contemplating of feelings, he said you contemplate if there's a pleasant feeling there, contemplate that. Pleasant feelings absent, contemplate that. The painful feelings there, contemplate that. Painful feelings absent, contemplate that. If a neutral feeling is there, contemplate that. And if a neutral feeling is absent, contemplate that. Okay, that's what the Satipatthana Sutta says, and I think that's a very good and very balanced approach. So, in your meditation, if you're sitting there and if you feel pain in your back or pain in your knees or something like that, and your mind's drawn towards that and you feel like you have to look at that, okay, you look at that, but that's 1/6 of your contemplation, right? And if you look at the painful feeling, also you look at the absence of the painful feeling, yeah? Where does that end? What happens when that ends? Yeah? You look at a pleasant feeling, so find somewhere where there's an experience of pleasant feeling, yeah? Contemplate that, the absence of the pleasant feeling, and the presence of a neutral feeling, yeah? Which is another thing, it's different from the absence of pain and pleasure, yeah? It's the presence of a neutral feeling, yeah? Contemplate that, or even the absence of a neutral feeling, how do you contemplate that? Yeah? Yeah? So that's how you see these things start to get more and more subtle and more and more interesting. Yeah? So you start to watch it. So you use these things are meant to be. So the Buddha taught these systems and these categories because they're meant to be used as guidelines for your practice and for your contemplation. And you say, well, what does that mean? Yeah? What does that mean to contemplate a neutral feeling? What does that mean to contemplate the absence of feeling? So you can go and have a look at all of those things actually as you experience them. And it doesn't matter whether, you know, maybe you're sitting there and you think, nah, it's all pain, right? That's all right too, but the point is that you keep looking, yeah? Because then one day you'll be sitting there and you realize, oh, actually it's not all pain, yeah? So maybe it's just pain for 6 months, yeah? And then something else will happen, you know? So this is where the patience comes in again. You know, in contemplating greed, hatred and delusion. Remember Ajahn Chah in his meditation, he said his first 2 years of meditation was just food. Alright? which you might think is an exaggeration, but it's not. Yeah? And especially if, you know, when you become a monk, because you only in forest tradition you only eat once a day, right? So it gives you plenty of time to think about food for the rest of the day. and all the good stuff that you can't eat. And, you know, Ajahn Chah's time, you know, Thai people love food, you know, so it's not an exaggeration. So 2 years just thinking about food, okay, and then you get bored and move on, right? After a while. So, but that was pretty much my experience as well. It was very similar. It was about 2 years thinking about food, sort of starting meditation, roughly. And then after a while you stop thinking about it and stop being so interested in it. And I'm not sure whether it's because of the meditation or different practices or whatever, or just got bored with it. But where was I? Oh yes, contemplation of the feelings, the presence and absence of things. And this reality of the present moment. So yes, so, and the other thing that's not even in the present moment is any meditation method. The meditation method is just a set of ideas. It's just a set of concepts. And so that can give a direction and orientation and so on for you, but it doesn't actually exist. Where does a meditation method exist? Does it exist in a book? Does it exist in a, you know? It's just something which is meant to help us and give us a guide to be able to connect with our own experience. So we have to be, I think this is something that's very, very important for us in our practice and in our Dhamma practice, is to recognize this, to recognize that this essence of this practice, of whether it's the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, the Five Khandhas, the Five Spiritual Faculties, all of these wonderful teachings that the Buddha taught, all of them just relate to what we experience, what is the reality of our experience. And all of those externals, you know, being Buddhist or living a certain lifestyle and so on, that those things are like, I mean, they're genuinely aspects of life. Of course, we still have to deal with those things. But leave them in their own sphere. This is the main point here, is that, you know, being a monk affects who I am. It's a very important part of who I am. But I leave that in its own sphere. It affects things like my fashion choices. And which I actually made a fashion choice this week for the first time in a long time, but I haven't got it here, but my outer robe of my Sangati, I replaced my Sangati for the first time. About 13 years I had my old one, so it's the kind of the outer robe, and finally it's just falling to bits too much to bother patching it up and so on, so I got a new one. And so, you know, there's a certain utility to this. You know, you don't have to worry about, well, is it going to match or anything like that, you know? And does it suit my complexion or something like that? And no, here it is, it's brown, and that's pretty much the way it stays. So, you know, and it affects things, you know, it affects like our choice of livelihood. So as a monk, then I rely only on donations, so we don't earn a living, for example. And so, you know, that's why you don't see me at the door here sort of collecting money from everyone and saying, you can only come in here if you're going to pay me. No, we don't do that. Everything, this is our livelihood, yeah? So this livelihood is a part of what it means to be me, a part of what my life is as a monk. But again, I just leave that in its own sphere. I don't take that with me where it doesn't need to be. And when the time comes to meditate, the time comes to confront who we are and the reality of who we are, we leave all those things behind. And so all of those notions of self, those notions of character, personality, who we are, forget about all of those things. You're not anybody. It's just this. What is this? What is this reality? What is this experience? What is this feeling I'm feeling? And not what is this in terms of a narrative. So unlike psychotherapy, which tends to want to explain things in terms of a life story, yes, you feel these kinds of feelings because you had these experiences as a child or something like that. Again, that has its own sphere, right? That's not unimportant or irrelevant, but leave that in its own sphere. What you're experiencing now is not a story. It's not a narrative. It's not a childhood trauma or experience from the past. It's not even past lives. What you're experiencing now is just now. It's just the present. And the curious thing about the present moment and contemplating the present moment is that it's so vivid. The present moment has this incredible concreteness to it. The colours, look around you. You compare the colours you can see with your eyes compared to the colours you can imagine in your mind. Yeah? The present moment is very concrete, it's very real, it's very vivid. And yet still, despite that, it seems so hard to say that, despite the fact that it's so vivid. Our mind still wants to wander off the past, the future, building up all of these worlds and the sense of me and all of those kinds of things. So again, just to come back to that, to remember to leave these things where they are. If we have a career, you do that career, do that as best you can. If you want to have that job, do that as best you can. If you want to teach something, teach that as best you can. If you're a plumber, fix the pipes as best you can. Be the best plumber in the world. If you're a bricklayer, be the best bricklayer in the world, except you can't quite be the best bricklayer in the world because we've got the best bricky in the world in Bundanoon, as it happens. It's true. Well, he's the second best. He came number two in the World Championship Bricklayers Competition in Korea. So that's his kind of sense of identity. And he's very, very good. Yeah. You can come down the monastery, you can see the bricks that he's laid. They're very straight. Yeah. And he did it very fast too. So that's his identity, number two bricklayer in the world. Yeah. So that's terrific, you do that. But then you leave all that when home, when you meditation, and you don't construct a new identity of me as a meditator. Of course, and that's what we do when we come to meditate. I'm a meditator. First thing about it is you feel incredibly pompous and self-righteous because you're actually meditating and they're not. Right? Husband's not meditating, or, you know, friend is not meditating or whatever. Yeah. And I am. So first of all, there's a sense of self-righteousness with that, so that's good. So just be aware of that, yeah? Not a problem. None of these things are problems, so just be aware of them. And then when you meditate, then if you sit for a certain amount of time and so on, then you feel good about yourself because you sit for a certain amount of time, and if your mind becomes peaceful, then you get attached to that peace. You think, oh, I'm a good meditator because I've got a nice peaceful mind, and they just sit there and think about stuff and so on. Or vice versa, most people the other way around, most people sit there and think about stuff and feel really depressed and down about themselves. So that's all just ego. Right? That's just bringing the ego into meditation. Don't worry about it. Right? Don't expect not to do it. Of course you do it. Yeah? It's worse. If people come to me and they say, oh, I had this experience, but I'm not attached to it, that's when I get worried. But of course you're attached to it. That'd be ridiculous. Right? So we know we're attached to it, that's all. And then it's not a problem. Yeah? But because it's that process of reflection on our attachment, that's the process that lets us let go. And if you keep on reflecting about it, then you naturally will learn to let go. So this is why when I teach meditation every week here, we always have that period, just a couple of minutes at the end, to reflect over the meditation. Let go of your meditation. Whatever's happened, good or bad, you let go about it and you reflect about it. Yeah? So this is the mind which is starting to distance itself from the meditation a bit. Yeah. Sometimes when people teach meditation, there's this thing that almost like that you keep doing the same thing in the meditation and you just keep doing it outside of meditation. I don't agree with that kind of teaching. I mean, it can be, if it's just in the sense of you're keeping a flow of mindfulness, well, then that's obviously okay. But there is a difference in that meditation should be bounded. Okay, meditation isn't 24 hours a day. Meditation is something which has a bounded space. So then we can... Boundaries are very useful, yeah? Because they allow us to create an effort, an expectation, a set of behaviours within that bounded sphere, which is then safe, yeah? And which can be left behind there. In your meditation, you can feel anything that you want to feel, anything which you have to feel, anything... Which emerges, and it's okay because that's in that space. Yeah? You can't experience those things when you're at work, yeah, or when you're on the bus. Yeah? In those kinds of places, it's not safe. You have to behave in a certain kind of way. If you're sitting in meditation and you want to just start sobbing and breaking down, that's fine. Just start sobbing. Yeah? Don't worry about it. Yeah? If you want to scream, just scream. I've done it many times, yeah. Had a good old scream. It's really good, especially good in forest monasteries, because there's no one to hear you. Yeah, echoes across the hillside, and someone living on the other side of the hill just hears this disembodied howl in the middle of the night. Yeah. So that you create that space, and it's bounded, and then when the time's finished, okay, you come up and you go about your life, yeah. So it's very important, actually, to have that boundary around the meditation, to have that thing, and to be able to reflect back over it. Yeah. Oh, okay. Then that's that period, and you can reflect, and then that gives you a bit of distance. Okay, that's what happened, and these feelings they came, and that's all finished now. Everything that's happened there is all finished, and that stays back inside that period of time. And then you get up and you go and do whatever you are. You pick up your sense of identity. You pick up your job, your role. I'm a mother, I'm a student, I'm a jogger, whatever. And you do that. and you carry that identity. You're a Buddhist. Well, go and be a good Buddhist. Be the best Buddhist that you can. You're not a Buddhist. That's fine. Go and be the best un-Buddhist that you can be. Doesn't matter. And then that alternating, if we can carry that, and then there's a certain level of consciousness and self-reflection about those roles, and so we don't get completely caught up with them. Of course, we still get attached to it. We still feel proud when we have an accomplishment. We still feel embarrassed or ashamed if we have a failure. So those feelings still come, but there's just that sense of being able to step back from it, step outside it, and just watch it. And see that relativity of things. So we don't get too caught up in them. And we know that whatever happens, yeah, no matter how stressful your life is, no matter how bad things get, yeah, that we always have that place of refuge. And again, this is another reason for keeping those boundaries around your meditation. You see if you insist on taking your meditation out of the space, meditation space, into your life, right? Your life will insist on repaying the favor, right? Your life will keep coming into your meditation. Yeah. So if you establish clear boundaries, now's the time to meditate. It's at this time, at this place, in this posture, and this is what I'm going to do. Then that helps you to train your mind to let go of all those things. Give yourself some space, and then at the end of it, then you can pick it up. And of course, this is the great simile which Ajahn Brahm always used for meditation, is the simile of the cup. And it's a brilliant simile for meditation. So that's what life is like, is holding a cup. And we don't feel that it's a burden or anything like that. But if we keep on holding it longer and longer and longer, eventually that cup, not very long time, the cup becomes incredibly heavy. And holding that cup up becomes the hardest thing in the world. Yeah? And it becomes the heaviest burden. And so meditation is just being able to put the cup down, that's all. That's us. That's our life. That's our bills. That's our deadlines. That's our shopping. That's that. That's our sense of me over there. We just put it down for a while. And then we need to pick it up, then you pick it up. Yeah? And so if you can do that, then the weight of it, the weight and the burden of things, is bearable, it becomes bearable. So this is one of the great similes that the Buddha said, Bhaarohave Panchakhanda, is that the five khandhas, which is our body and our mind, is a burden that we have to carry around. Yeah? It's something that's very heavy. So we learn to put them down. We learn to forget about it. Yeah. And it's that putting down of things and that forgetting about them which is what gives us some peace and sense of ease. So it's just a little talk for you this evening about the present moment and finding a sense of rest and ease through the present moment. And I'd like to invite if there's any comments or questions from tonight's talk. Or if anybody has any good jokes.
Mm-hmm. Dad, I have a question about forgiveness, letting go, and forgiveness, letting go, and forgetting. Somebody said to me, we can forgive, but we don't forget. Because if we forget, then we may fall into the same trap again. Because we don't learn from experience. And say, for example, somebody has committed a wrongdoing,
yep.
You know, which is quite major, for example,
yep.
And then that person says sorry, and being truly apologetic. Say, for example, I can forgive him, but then I would be cautious from then on,
yep.
Because then he might actually do the same thing again. Is that letting go?
Yeah, no, that's just wisdom. Yeah? You have to know how to you know. I mean, trust is something.
I wouldn't trust that person in the same way.
Yeah, yeah.
Again, and then so.
Well, you shouldn't. Mm. Yeah, I mean, trust is not something you should give absolutely to all people all the time. You know, you trust when it's deserved. If they're not worthy of it, then don't give it. I mean, that's a different thing. I talked about this. I remember I talked about this with Angie Monksfield in the Buddhist Fellowship in Singapore one time. And she made a very good point. She said, you know, I love my children all the time. You know, she's got two little kids. She said, I love them unconditionally all the time, but I don't trust them. Yeah. I know if I turn my back, they're going to get up to all kinds of mischief. Yeah. So, yeah. And I think that's like the real forgiveness, is to be able to fully know and accept what somebody has done, you know, and to really be able to let it go, you know, rather than just trying to push it out of your mind and trying to make yourself forget, which is that kind of mechanism of repression, which.
Not having trust, but having love coming.
Mm-hmm.
In a relationship, that's a given.
Yeah.
But in a relationship to a friend or something, that's a different.
Yeah.
And so in breath meditation, to what extent can one sort of develop wisdom? Because there's that common idea that, you know, that it develops concentration and then to develop panya. But to what extent can one observe, say, you know, but just through watching the breath, you see the rising and passing of thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
Can one gain quite a solid sort of level of wisdom on impermanence, like, you know, through mindfulness of thought, through breathing mm-hmm. meditation, or is it?
Okay, it's a good question. Well, there's a number of different ways you can do it. Right? One way, which is which people use, which is quite commonly, which is that you use like the breath as an anchor or a basis, and then you can observe your thoughts and so on through that. And that's one way of meditation. I don't particularly think it's a particularly good way of practicing, personally. But on a more profound level, is just by paying attention to the breath. I mean, of course, thoughts and so on will always come, and they'll always, you know, be mindful of them. But real samatha practice or real samadhi practice is you just pay attention to the breath and ignore everything else. Right? When you do that, things cease at a much more profound level. Okay, rather than just coming and going, coming and going, coming and going, they actually stop. Yeah, and you can and for example, you can when you're breathing, you can feel like each individual breath as it starts and finishes, yeah? But that's different from seeing breathing cease. Yeah? And so when mind gets concentrated, you have that experience where the breath actually completely stops and there's nothing there. And so through that that experience of calming the mind, there's a much more radical sense of experience of cessation. Yeah. I think as long as your experience of impermanence is just the kind of the general stuff. And the Pali word they use for that is the pakinaka sankhara, which is just the miscellaneous or day-to-day stuff of the mind, activities of the mind. That's impermanence at one level. That's one aspect of impermanence. But there's a big difference between seeing just things coming and going and seeing them just stop. Yeah, and that's where the deep insights start to happen.
And one of the things that has ceased. When they arise again, there's a deeper understanding.
Exactly.
Yeah. Noticing the difference.
Exactly. Yeah, it's much more dramatic.
Okay.
Yeah.
So say like Ajahn Mun, for instance. Oh. And I always remember, you know, one of the first things I read, I think it's opening page. He was a Vipassana master,
uh-huh.
or something. But I think I asked you before that the Thai idea of Vipassana is different to the Burmese.
Mm-hmm.
You know, rendition of it being a meditation technique or a practice.
Mm-hmm.
So what do the Thais mean when one cultivates vipassana?
It can be used in different contexts. In a technical or scholarly context, it really has pretty much the same meaning. But in a general context, vipassana actually just means meditation, and that's actually an old Pali usage as well. Like you have in talking about the monastic lifestyle, there's an old classification system in the Pali commentaries where it says you can either be Gantadura or Vipassanadura, where Gantadura is a study, one takes up the duty of study, and Vipassanadura is one takes up the duty of meditation. So in that context, the word vipassana is just a word for meditation generally. Yeah? So it's used in both of those senses in Thailand, where it's either just means meditation, or where it's used, sometimes they use it specifically to mean like the Burmese vipassana techniques and so on as well.
So it's quite broad in Thailand, as opposed to, I guess, Burma's quite regimented, is that right? You know, this is how it is, you cultivate samadhi and then you do these practices.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. The Burmese approach is much more Abhidhamma based.
Yeah.
So it's based on a foundation of a very kind of scholastic and very precise academic understanding of Dhamma, which is then applied to meditation. Whereas in the Thai approach is much more intuitive and much more like Ajahn Chah's own description. He would say, you know, he just would look at those fundamental teachings like the Four Noble Truths and so on, and just try to apply them as rigorously and as authentically as he could. Yeah. So there's definitely a difference in orientation.
Yeah. Okay. What do you see the relationship between samadhi and vipassana? You seem to be blurring the two, is that right?
Yeah, well, you can't, yeah. Well, okay. Yeah, go on. The way the sutras put it is that there's no clear hierarchy between them either. It's one of the basic suttas where it talks about it. See, some of the teachings you find in the suttas are actually very, very subtle and get almost lost in the tradition. But there's one beautiful sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya which says that it talks about two kinds, like when we talk about enlightenment, right? So someone who's an arahant or someone who's enlightened. They use two words for that in Pali. They use many words, but one particular set of two words is cheto vimuti, panya vimuti. Okay? Cheto vimuti means release of heart, and panya vimuti means release by wisdom. Okay? So these are like the emotional and the intellectual or cognitive sides of enlightenment. Right? So both are, it's like the left brain and the right brain. We've both got these sides, okay? We've both got these aspects within us. Yeah, the emotional, intuitive side, and we have the intellectual and understanding side. And arahantship is expressed through both of those terms. And the sutta goes on to say, well, that release of the heart, that emotional liberation, comes through the ending of raga, right? So the ending of attachment or desire or whatever. It's like the emotional aspect of of the mind which is causing suffering, whereas the release through wisdom is caused by the ending of ignorance, avijja viraga. So again, these two aspects of defilements in the heart, yeah, the emotional attachments and then the intellectual or the cognitive unknowing, yeah? Two things both have to end. And then it goes on and says, well, it's samatha practice, okay, which leads to that emotional release. And it's vipassana practice which leads to that release by wisdom, the panya vimuti. So they're both of them working together to address equally real and equally important aspects of our psyche. And so neither of them can be neglected. So the important aspect is that it's not a particular technique, it's not about a technique or anything like that. It's about actually how are we addressing those forces in the mind which are leading to suffering. And so samatha and vipassana are simply ways that we use, tranquility and insight, are simply ways that we use to address those problems, the kind of causes of problems, causes of suffering.
Okay. Can I ask a question about the feelings and emotions and in relation to your question, say, what 12 ways can you pain to feel on my part? Theme changes but then you said if you have painful feeling, you can also note where the pain isn't, like there's a neutral feeling maybe elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean yet that you're kind of running around your body.
Well, you can do.
So, in that way, if I was going to be doing that, then I would get mixed up between the idea that something's painful and then somewhere else where I don't feel anything is neutral.
Mm-hmm.
And then the absence of neutral feeling would be like, I just feel like I would be inventing neutral. You know what I mean?
Well, the absence of neutral is inventing neutral.
Invent neutral in that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but it might not be neutral. See, the absence of neutral feeling might be a pleasant feeling.
Yeah.
So, but it's just...
So it's not just an absence of... It's just...
There's an absence. Absence is never a complete absence.
No.
Yeah? That thing that you're watching is absent. But maybe there's something else there.
Yeah, so I was going to relate that. Sorry, this is a continuing question. To what Sam said about... I'm not going to hang my brain just very much, not forget it all, but that the... like when a thing speaks, that's different to an absence. When thinking ceases,
Why is that different from an absence?
Well, yes, that would be my question.
No, it's the same.
Yeah. Okay.
That's what I was meaning, yeah?
Yeah.
The cessation of the ending of things, yeah.
Yeah.
The absence of them, yeah. It's the same.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, I trust you.
Well, see, the absence of cessation, like, if you walk into this room and there's no sound, that's one thing, it's just a quiet room. But if those dogs are yelping there all night, and then they stop, right, then the absence of those... The cessation of those dogs stopping, of yelping, is different than if there'd never been any dogs yelping, you see?
Yeah, but if you're talking about feeling, silence is neutral. Silence is something that, then there's neutral, then there's painful.
You can respond to silence in different ways. Sometimes silence can be very, very painful. It's a response to them. Yeah. It's part of the matrix of response.
Can't pain be your teacher?
No, not really. Pain can be... pain shouldn't be your teacher. The Buddha is your teacher. And the Buddha is not pain. Pain can be one of the companions or people you meet along the journey. Yeah. You can spend some time with, yeah. But I wouldn't... go into discipleship under pain. Yeah.
Is it something to do with our lack of being able to live in the present moment that makes, say, physical pain, for example, so unbearable? If we're within the present moment, there's a painful feeling, and we're just noting that painful feeling without thinking of the painful feeling that was in the past and projecting how long is this painful feeling going to last, you're only experiencing it from moment to moment rather than...
That's right, yeah, and then the fear goes, because the fear is the fear of pain in the future, yeah? So when it's just that pain now, then it's no big deal, actually. Yeah.
Can I ask grief?
Handle.
I don't understand the beautiful concept.
Uh-huh.
I'm looking back on that
lately. Okay, yeah.
The human being.
Yeah.
When grief comes up, how do you handle it?
First thing, the way to handle it is just to know it. Yeah, it's just an experience, and you feel it. You feel it in your heart. You feel it come up, and you feel it. It pervades your whole body. Yeah, it's a whole body experience. So the first thing you do is just feel it, and that's really the best way of relating to all of our emotions and so on, just to feel it. And most of the time, if you can just do that, then it will just wash through you. It's impermanent, it'll come, it'll stay for a time and it will disappear. If it doesn't, then that's often because we're not... I mentioned when I was talking about meditation, I mentioned that ability to step back a little bit from it and to reflect on it. So this is again why we try to we train our mind like that every time we meditate. It's the ability, even those beautiful or peaceful feelings you have in meditation, to train yourself to step back from it and reflect on it. Now, if we're not able to do that, if the feeling's too strong, yeah, or if we're just too caught up in it, too involved, we can't disidentify from it, and then the story. We can't step back from the story and reflect on it. So if that happens, that's the time when those kinds of reflections, like you mentioned the story of Ajahn Brahm and so on, the beautiful concert, and to reflect back and say, well, that was, you know, like if someone's died, that's their life, you know, and it was a beautiful thing while it was there, and now it's gone. And so there's a sense of peacefulness. So that's where you use those reflections to gain some kind of sort of to give you sort of enough sense of ease and soothing that you can actually step back and reflect on it. This is another thing to try. But if those another thing also to do, which I think is a very good thing to do, is to think, well, what would that person want? Yeah. What would actually they want? Do they want me to be sad? Right? Am I making them happy by being sad? And you say, well, if they would want anything, I mean, I would imagine that if someone's died and they're sort of floating around in the heaven realm, looking down at us, going around in our lives being miserable because they're dead, and you know, they're probably looking down at us, thinking that they're perfectly happy and so on. And actually, there are stories like that. I've read some stories of like near-death experiences and so on, where people have died. And then they're aware of people around them grieving and so on, and they've been perfectly happy, yeah, and just looking back at all the people who are grieving. But what would somebody actually want? What I would want, if somebody wanted to, was to remember me when I'd gone, the thing that I would want them to do is to do something good in my name, yeah, to remember me that way, yeah. So to think, well, okay, did they have something that they really believed in? Something which was really important to them. Did they have a lot of love of children? Okay, well, I'll give to a medical fund for children. Did they have a lot of sympathy for the poor? Okay, well, I'll make a donation to the poor. Did they have a great connection with the environment? Okay, I'll give something to a green fund, or I'll go out and plant some trees. And to actually do something, because it's in that doing that we are, because the grief brings a sense of hopelessness. This is one of the problems. Grief is like hope, because we've lost something and we can't do anything about it. We've lost control. So if we can bring a sense of agency back into our life, no, we can actually do something good. Yeah? Then to me, that's a very powerful force as well. Yeah. Okay, so we're getting a little bit late, so we should maybe wrap up. Okay, so let's finish off by paying respects to the Triple.